This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Could data from period tracking apps be used against people who seek abortion care? That was a concern after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. But since then, Ohio voters enshrined the right to an abortion in the state's constitution. Does that help protect patients' privacy? Joining me now to address these questions are Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Dean Judith Darr. Welcome back, Judith.
Great to be with you, Lucy. Thanks so much.
Great to have you. Case Western Reserve University School of Law Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development, Jesse Hill. Thanks for being here, Jesse.
Thank you for having me.
And in Trust IT Cybersecurity Consultant, Dave Hatter. Welcome back, Dave.
Always my pleasure, Lucy. Thanks.
Jesse, there was a lot of talk about data privacy immediately following the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision in 2022, but that was before Ohio voters approved this constitutional amendment that guarantees the right to an abortion up to fetal viability. What impact does that amendment have on privacy concerns in Ohio, if any?
Yeah, that's it's an interesting question. I think, you know, nothing really directly in the amendment speaks to privacy or reproductive health data or anything like that. But it does create, of course, a right to access reproductive health care without government interference. I mean, so to the extent that concerns about privacy might be driven by people's concerns about, you know, being prosecuted for accessing or helping someone access care, of course, you know, that should be taken off the table by issue one. But really, you know, a lot of these data privacy issues themselves have been around before, very much after Dobbs, and you know, are not directly affected by the amendment itself.
Judith, what about for people from other states who might travel to Ohio for abortion care because of the constitutional protections that Ohio has? Does the amendment give them any kind of protections from prosecution?
Thanks, Lucy. I think just to set the stage, it'd be interesting for our listeners to understand that the intersection between data privacy protection and health information protection, I would say, is very narrow, and Dave may want to comment on this at some point. So your question about individuals traveling to Ohio to avail our more permissive abortion landscape, it, as Professor Hill said, doesn't really interact with the data privacy. So, for example, if there is location or geofencing information available about where an individual travels, that might be known to law enforcement. And to the extent that a state that prohibits abortion is somehow interested in tracking a woman who travels to a friendlier state, then that information about their inquiries on Google and et cetera, where they go, their location, that is something that might be captured and used in some kind of a criminal prosecution.
Well, and Jesse, HIPAA doesn't really apply to these apps, does it?
Well, that's right. And I mean, the definition of covered entities is it's very specific within HIPAA who has to comply with HIPAA. So I'll just say as a general matter that most of these apps that people use just for period tracking purposes or similar things like that are not going to be entities that have to comply strictly with that federal law in terms of its, you know, protection for protected health information and personal health information. So I think that's one of the difficulties here is that people often just don't realize that. They assume that their private health information is somehow protected by law without recognizing that that law only applies, you know, to particular kinds of healthcare providers and other related organizations.
Dave, you know, we mentioned that these concerns started with women kind of worrying about these period tracking apps, but what should users of these apps or really any of these kind of health and wellness related apps be looking for in terms of usage policies when it comes to privacy?
Well, Lucy, let me put my tinfoil hat on and say, A, I'm glad you have two lawyers on here because I think they made an important distinction about the covered entities and the fact that most of these mobile apps that are, quote, free, unquote, right? You're paying with your data, not your money. You are their product, not their customer. Don't have laws like HIPAA applied to them, which means essentially, if you don't understand the terms of service, which usually you need an attorney to understand because it's 80 pages of mumbo jumbo. And I'd like to point out to folks, if you really want to understand this, just go look up any sort of fitness or health tracking app. Let's take Fitbit, for example. I used to be an avid Fitbit user, and when Google bought the company, I said, I'm done because Google is not privacy friendly. If you go and you look at the App Store and you look at the Apple privacy label for Fitbit, it collects health and fitness information, location, user content, usage data, diagnostics, purchases, contact info, identifiers, sensitive info, and, quote, other data. Now, that's the high level. You can dig into it and get more information than that. My point being, all of that data is going to some private company. You don't really know what they're doing with it, who they're selling it to, what happens to it if they go out of business, which is why, in general, my advice is use as few apps as possible, and I would not use any sort of health or fitness tracking app, period, because I don't trust any of these companies with this kind of sensitive data and no law really to control it.
We're talking about data privacy in a post-Roe world and whether protections enshrined in Ohio's Constitution make a difference. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Dave, you know I always appreciate your tinfoil hat perspective. What does it take for information like this to be truly private? Is it a matter of encryption? Is it a matter of this data being stored on your device and not in the cloud? Like, how do you get true privacy?
You're asking the right kind of questions, Lucy, and it's really hard. Now, I also always like to point out, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, because they are, right? And unfortunately, the companies that are monetizing this data, and I'm not saying it's all in nefarious ways, but again, kind of going back to you're not protected under various laws, although some states have privacy laws, like Kentucky has one now. It's not that rigorous, frankly. So once they have your data, for the most part, they can do whatever they want with it. They can sell it to the government, for example, and they get around the Fourth Amendment with that particular approach on a regular basis. Encryption is always good, but you got to understand how it works and understand that if, for example, even if you're using end-to-end encryption in an app like Signal, which is a good messaging app, if I get your password or you're compelled to give up your password, well, that's out the window. But in general, you know, end-to-end encryption is something you want to look for. Ideally, you're going to use privacy-friendly products to begin with, things like the Firefox browser or the Tor browser or the Brave browser. Use a VPN, a virtual private network, and you want one that doesn't capture logs. I use Proton for my own personal use. It's a logless VPN, so if you're connected to the internet over a VPN like Proton and you're using privacy-friendly browsers and you turn on the privacy settings so that you minimize the tracking and then you use as few apps as possible because, for example, many of these apps have some kind of web-based interface. If you use these techniques I just described, you can minimize the amount of information they're able to capture about you kind of surreptitiously, then they're only going to get whatever you give up. But in general, understand they're not building these apps for you out of the goodness of their heart. Whether it's a period tracking app or a fitness tracking app or whatever, if it's free, quote unquote, your money is how they pay the bills, or your data is how they pay the bills. They want your data. And, you know, where it goes from there kind of depends on their terms of service and their ultimate business objectives.
Judith, Dave just mentioned that Kentucky has a data privacy law that he's not a huge fan of, I guess. And I read a recent article that said, I think it's something like 18 states in the U.S. have enacted privacy laws. How much protection do these state laws offer generally?
My understanding is that they vary. As Dave said, they can be somewhat weak or they can try to be somewhat strong. But I think an important point to raise is that there is no comprehensive federal data privacy law in the U.S., unlike in Europe and other places. So that as much as we have intrastate travel, we're not necessarily going to get those protections that we would with a federal law. And to the main point about the interaction between data privacy and reproductive choice, and I think Professor Hill can talk about this as well. We know that digital footprints have been used to prosecute reproductive cases, and this is even before the Dobbs decision. So this isn't just a theoretical concern. What we research, who we email, who we text, where we visit, these are all information points that prosecutors have used to prosecute cases involving reproductive choice.
Jesse, can you talk more about that? Because, you know, there was a lot of worry about these period tracking apps, but authorities have used all kinds of things like search results and texts and things like that to prosecute people. Talk about the role of that kind of data in these cases.
Absolutely. And I think that's kind of one of the misconceptions, you know, as Judy was just saying, that, like, you know, this information can definitely be used in prosecutions and has been. You know, a lot of times is so it's important not to focus too much on these specific kinds of apps, right? Even though, you know, they definitely have their dangers, as Dave was pointing out. But like in a lot of these prosecutions, you know, the information comes to the attention of law enforcement by some other means, traditional investigation means, maybe a disgruntled partner or parent or, you know, friend or colleague tips someone off, you know, and then they can use that as a basis for investigating and getting all kinds of, you know, electronic data. And sometimes that kind of information can play a role too. So it's really important not to think that it's all about just staying off the apps. You know, these prosecutions proceed in a lot of different ways. And also, I just want to point out that there have even been situations where, you know, it's not just a person being prosecuted. It's not a person being prosecuted for having an abortion. So in every state right now, it's the case that the pregnant person is immune themselves from being prosecuted for having an abortion. It's people who help or who provide the abortion that are subject to prosecution. But, you know, sometimes there are misunderstandings among law enforcement, or sometimes there are other consequences, like, you know, child custody consequences, you know, investigations that may not lead to prosecution, but that still change someone's life, that can come out of police getting this information and using it to, you know, to follow the trail. So so there's a lot of reasons to be really careful about your information, not just through these apps, but in every respect.
Judith, you mentioned the lack of a federal law. How would that help? And are there things being discussed that could be helpful at the federal level?
Well, in the health privacy arena, HIPAA, which I think your listeners are familiar with. And by the way, HIPAA turns 28 today. It was signed on August 21st, 1996. That does protect the disclosure of protected health information. But again, it's very limited because it's really information that arises in the doctor-patient relationship context and not health information that you generate or share about yourself. So a federal law that was a companion law, as you asked about, Lucy, to HIPAA might have broader coverage. But I think at the end of the day, it would be impossible to eliminate our digital footprint for law enforcement purposes. And I just want to add, I'm not as optimistic as Professor Hill that women who self-manage abortions cannot be the subject of prosecution. As we've talked, Lucy, in prior shows, some of the states that have very strict abortion laws that take effect at 6 weeks or so that prohibit abortion and criminalize it at that point are very broad in their definition of who is captured by the law. And I'm not so confident that it wouldn't include women who self-manage their own abortion based on some of the plain meaning of those statutes.
Dave, would a federal law make you feel any better about, you know, going back to your Fitbit maybe? Or would you feel any better about data if there were broader federal protections for privacy?
Well, Lucy, you know, generally I'm an anti-regulation guy, especially in the tech space, because usually the tech is moving much more quickly than Congress can deal with. However, in this case, if we could just go off topic for 1 second, take a look at this recent national public data breach that was recently announced. So this is a background company that has incredibly sensitive information about you, where you've worked, your relatives, et cetera. There's 3 billion records roughly released out there now. I mean, this is a complete disaster. If you had some sort of national privacy law, maybe something along the lines of GDPR out of Europe, you know, there would potentially be serious consequences to these companies. But unfortunately, and if we look at like what Kentucky passed, it's way better than nothing. And for the first time in my whole life, I think Kentucky beat Ohio to something useful. I just want to go on record and say that. I know Ohio has something brewing, but if you had some kind of comprehensive national law and there were consequences, then instead of you as the consumer always suffering the consequences of this with identity theft and all the other stuff that comes along with it, you know, perhaps companies would be more incentivized to do the right thing. Now, there's nothing you can do that will make your business impervious to these kinds of attacks, but we see these things, Ticketmaster, over and over and over again, sensitive data like this leak, which then, you know, becomes a problem for you as a consumer. And I want to echo, you know, one of the sentiments before about digital footprints. Hard to live in today's world and not leave digital footprints. There are things you can do. Again, use privacy-friendly products. Use a VPN. But understand that once law enforcement gets involved, they have subpoena power to go after the companies that would have access to the underlying data. Unless you're super sophisticated, you know, like James Bondian type spy, it is very, very difficult to become totally anonymous. Mm. And people need to understand, if it's digital, you don't have much privacy unless you're pretty sophisticated and using the right kind of tools. And even then, you may get caught.
Mm. You know, Jesse, Dave had mentioned before that these apps, these free, I'm using air quotes that our listeners can't see right now, but these free apps are marketing this data. We're the product. Our data is the product. What are the implications of that for people who might want to access abortion care at some point in the future? Do you have thoughts on what they should be keeping in mind as they use, you know, whether it's a period tracker or some other kind of fitness app to keep track of their health?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a good moment to sort of think about that question more generally, because we really aren't very careful, most of us. I say we, I have to include myself. We aren't very careful about what we put online, what we put into apps, what information is floating around in the cloud about us. And I think that while the concerns are very real in the reproductive health context, and I want to take a minute to circle back to Dean Darr's comment, because I totally agree. So I didn't mean to imply that people aren't being threatened with criminal prosecution and other consequences, right? I'm just, even because the law, you don't always need a law that specifically outlaws abortion or even self-managed abortion. Police and prosecutors are finding ways, various legal hooks, to prosecute individuals even now. So, you know, there is this real climate of fear that is quite legitimate about, and you know, that makes people want to keep their reproductive health information as private as possible, on the concern that they might be criminalized. But I think at the same time, you know, it's a good wake-up call that we all should be paying attention to this about all of our private information, because it is way too available, and there are way too few protections out there for the most personal of data.
Would you like to add to that, Dave?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you even move away from abortion and any of the politics around that, I totally agree with the comment. You need to be thinking about what's out there about you. Take, for example, you go on your browser right now because you saw a commercial on TV for some new drug. You're just curious what it is. Okay, that gets sold to some company that eventually has a, quote, algorithm, air quotes again here, Lucy, that can, you know, dictate whether you're going to be in a good insurance risk or something. You could potentially be denied or have your insurance premiums increased because of something you searched for online. Look, I encourage people to go see this for themselves. GM was selling your driving information. This isn't you signed up for Allstate and plugged something into your car and it tracked you because you agreed to it. They were selling your information to insurance companies who were then altering your rates without you really understanding why. You know, sadly, everything is a computer now. Everything collects data. These so-called smart devices or the Internet of Things, which is really the Internet of Insecure Things. So yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, and because it sounds tinfoil hat-ish, and you know, I'm not in a bunker most of the time, but the less information there is out there about you, especially if you don't understand these potential downstream consequences of people buying and aggregating and selling and aggregating and selling this information, which may not even be right about you or just some casual interest you had, comes back to bite you in ways that are not only hard to understand, but may be totally invisible to you. You didn't get a job because of some internet search that you did. Hmm. Sadly, that's where we are.
Judith, is there anything you'd like to add about the implications specifically for people who might want or need to access abortion care in the future?
In an ironic or perhaps catch-22 way, information is power. And women who are navigating their reproductive lives need information to have power over their futures. So the fact that they have to make a choice between accessing healthcare and being subject to disclosure, discovery in a criminal or even a civil liability context is a reality. And I think the more we understand that, the more that we can co-opt our power in a meaningful and impactful way.
Jesse, I'm going to ask both you and Judith this. I guess I'm wondering, are there different ways people should be protecting their personal data if they live in a state? And I'm talking here specifically about reproductive care. We know what Dave thinks. Protect all your data.
Yes, all the time.
All the time, everybody. But if we're talking about data that could be related to reproductive care, to abortion care, are there different ways people should be protecting that personal data if they live in a state where the right to abortion is guaranteed, like Ohio, versus a state where it's not like Kentucky. Jesse, do you have thoughts on that?
Wow. Well, I mean, I think that the difference between a place where abortion is protected, like Ohio, and a state where it's not, is mainly about the consequences of that information being released on the back end, right? In terms of how it might be used and is likely to be used against you. I think the reality is that whether you live in Ohio or Kentucky, you just may not want your private reproductive healthcare information being shared out there. Or, you know, you may not live there forever. You may live in other places, and you may not want that information to be accessible to people. So I think that, you know, that the real problem is more, and I think both Dave and Judy were getting at this, the bigger problem is that there aren't real affirmative protections that people can avail themselves of, regardless of where they live. And that's where the gap is here.
Yeah. Judith, do you think there are special considerations for people who live in states where abortion care is not protected?
Well, certainly when Dobbs was decided, there was a lot of discussion about prosecutors using this information aggressively in those particular states in which the trigger laws became effective. We haven't really seen that in any greater number than we had prior to Dobbs. So that remains. We have a couple of years of experience, so we really haven't seen that. But to your question, your preliminary question about what can people do to protect themselves, I mean, there are suggestions about old-fashioned paper and pencil to track your cycles, and perhaps bypassing your own digital footprint by asking others to do searches for you. But that really, again, complicates the bottom line need that people have for information. So it seems that there is a risk involved, and you have to balance the risk as you navigate your way to your reproductive health.
Well, I've been talking with Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Dean Judith Darr, Case Western Reserve University School of Law Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development Jesse Hill, and Entrust IT Cybersecurity Consultant Dave Hatter. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lucy.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. And if you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.